couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Army of the Dead, Dream Horse, Final Account, Solos, and MODOK. I'm also going to be talking about some news and the trailer park, as well as the home cinema roundup featuring The Vigil. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The first piece of news is a sad one. We have to say goodbye to Charles Grodin. He died this week of bone marrow cancer at the age of 86. He's such a well-known actor. Grodin had a dramatic potential, but he was at his best when he was doing sort of that deadpan delivery in comedy. I had just recently watched over the last couple weeks, like three Charles Grodin movies. I watched Midnight Run. If you remember a couple weeks ago, I talked about the Beverly Hills Cop series, and Martin Brest, who directed the first one, had also directed Midnight Run. And I'd never seen that, so I wanted to watch that. So I caught that. It was on HBO Max. And I recently watched Clifford for some insane reason, that horrible comedy with Martin Short playing a 12-year-old boy. And that also stars Charles Grodin. And I also watched and talked about last week King Kong, the 1976 version, which he was in. So it's funny, you look back at some of these movies, and he was in dozens and dozens of movies, movies you forget that he was in. You know, like he had a bit part in like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And I'm looking through his filmography, and I'm like, oh yeah, he was in Rosemary's Baby, wasn't he? I forgot that he was in that movie. I would say probably my favorite performances of his, the first one has got to be The Great Muppet Caper, which is the second Muppet movie they made. And that's not a great movie because, it has some brilliant stuff, and they really took some chances, which I thought was very, very irreverent. But it's imperfect. It has some flaws and hiccups throughout. But making Charles Grodin fall in love with Miss Piggy was one of the greatest things ever seen on the big screen back then. I think that was just, it was just hilarious. Now, the other thing that he did that was a very deadpan comedic delivery was in So I Married an Axe Murderer. He was a guy whose car was being commandeered and he just refused to get out. And it was very funny because it's out of nowhere, this small little like one scene performance by Charles Grodin. And that was the kind of actor he was. You know, he went and he did little bits here and there. And I really respected him for that. And, it's sad to see him go. I mean, he has such a great filmography. He just shows up and stuff. And that's, one of the joys of some of these actors who's well known by name, but is also in his own right a character actor. So he will be missed. Rest in peace, Charles Grodin. The next piece I want to talk about is about the box office. And if you remember, if you've listened to the show long enough, pre-pandemic, I would have a box office segment. Well, box office isn't kind of back into a situation to talk about on a weekly basis. And it may never be because they don't report streaming numbers in the same way that they report box office numbers. So in that sense, you know, like what Warner Brothers is doing, the hybrid releases, movies out in theaters and on HBO Max, you don't know exactly what revenue any specific movie is generating for the studio. It's more about retention of subscribers. I remember reading the reports where Spiral ended up making about $8.7 million, and it suddenly got reported this was underperforming, this isn't as good, they were expecting it to be in the 20s, and yeah, it made less than $10 million its opening weekend during a pandemic. And the other thing people pointed to was how low of a Rotten Tomatoes score it had. But here's the thing, it made less than $10 million, but a lot of these other Saw movies, Saw 2, I think had the biggest opening weekend, which was $31 million. But, you know, some of these other ones were not making great money its opening weekend. I mean, if you look at, like, Saw 6, which is the lowest performing box office of the regular Saw series, that movie only made $14 million its opening weekend. That was with no pandemic. I don't know what people are expecting. I mean, $8.7 million is actually kind of respectable for what this movie was trying to do. And if you compare its $8.7 million opening weekend, especially compared to the less than $3 million that Those Who Wish Me Dead made, it did better than Nobody did its opening weekend. It did better than Wrath of Man its opening weekend. Sure, it didn't top Godzilla or Mortal Kombat, but honestly, those numbers aren't bad for the pandemic setting we're still in. It just has to make it a $20 million budget left, which, you know, if by the time it does its rounds at the box office, international, VOD, it's going to be well beyond that. Those Who Wish Me Dead is another story because it had extremely low numbers. And what that shows is it doesn't mean that everybody's going to see every movie that's coming out this weekend. And especially when you're given an online option, like you were with HBO Max, people might gravitate towards that. If we look at the box office numbers over the last couple weekends, I think what this actually shows is that people will go back to theaters if there's a real reason to actually go to the theater. I mean, if it's something like Godzilla, that's a big screen movie. Even Mortal Kombat, you can make that distinction. But Spiral, it's not a movie that demands a theatrical experience. I think it would play just as well at home. I actually got a digital screener of it. I rewatched it over the weekend at home, and I don't think this experience was marginally different. I think we're still in that matter of figuring out what's going to bring people back to theaters, and some movies, it might be smarter to put them either in a hybrid model or completely online going forward. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first trailer I want to hit comes from Netflix, and it is for Fear Street, which is going to be premiering as three separate movies in three consecutive weekends on July 2nd, 9th, and 16th.
We're all cursed. The witch is real.
She put a curse on Shadyside.
She's been possessing people, turning them into killers to take revenge on the town. It happens to Shadyside over and over.
Bad things happen here. You can't stop her.
Your best chance is to run from this place.
Netflix has been playing around with gimmicks. And I mean, gimmicks in a good sense, not in a sense that it's a trick to get you to go see their movies. Like they did the interactive stuff. They did Bandersnatch and they did an interactive sort of choose your own adventure style movie for the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt finale. And with Fear Street, it looks like they basically have a three-part movie. One of them takes place in 1994, another one takes place in 1978, and the other one takes place in 1666. And they're all tied together. And I think that's actually kind of cool. And of course, it's grounded in the R.L. Stine Fear Street teen model, but I like the idea of playing around with established structures of limited series and micro series and mini series and playing with what we can do now that we have streaming. So I'm looking forward to what they do with this. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Snake Eyes, which is in theaters on July 23rd.
Every warrior has a beginning.
I'm on a new level.
For 600 years. Our ninja have brought peace to the world.
I'm on a new level.
I need warriors like you. Join us.
What do I have to do?
The journey from here is yours to decide. But that is just the beginning.
This is a G.I. Joe origin story. And if you remember, they tried to do this with the Marvel characters in the X-Men, where they did X-Men Origins Wolverine. And we didn't get any more X-Men origin stories. It sort of morphed into First Class is what that turned into. But this is some of the characters from G.I. Joe. I think they're trying to do spinoff movies. And of course, this is Snake Eyes, Henry Golding, who's hot right now. He's playing the lead character. I mean, this looks like it's going to be an okay action movie. It's a little late. It's been like 6-7 years since the last G.I. Joe movie or more. It's been a while. So this just looks like a nice little action movie for the summer. And this is the kind of thing that Paramount wants to bring people back to theaters because they don't even have a streaming model right now. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Final Account and Solos.
Thank you.
back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Final Account. A documentary filmmaker spends a decade interviewing the surviving Germans who were involved in the Third Reich when they were younger.
Focus Features and Participant present an unprecedented documentary event. For the first time on record, the children of Nazi Germany give their final account in what may well be the last testimony of its kind.
Now, I'm going to warn you, it's a documentary, so, you know, it's not an action movie. And it also is almost completely in German because it's a German guy interviewing Germans. So everybody speaks German. So, yes, you're going to have to read subtitles. Sorry, folks. But this is a fascinating movie because it interviews people who were children when the Nazis essentially came to power. I mean, maybe they were teenagers. And here you got to realize, people in America, you have no idea the difference between living as a teenager in America now versus living as a teenager in Germany post-World War I. Things were very, very different. It was the old world. You know, they didn't have any sort of TV or internet. So I think the most telling thing about this is it shows some footage from back then, some film footage. And now we've been so used to knowing that the Nazis were a horrible party. And the symbols of the Nazis are extremely jarring to suddenly just see show up. But that wasn't the case 100 years ago. You know, you started seeing a Nazi flag back then in Germany, and that was just another political party. It was not a symbol of horror that it is today, because a lot of the atrocities hadn't even happened yet, you know, early in the days of the Nazi party. And so you see some of the things that Hitler was doing and stuff like the Hitler Youth, and there was even a younger version of that, and they were talking to people who were involved in it, and the boys were involved in the Hitler Youth, and the girls were involved in basically the female version of that. And for some of them, as you hear them talking, they're just like, well, they were just doing it because that's how you were involved. You know, that's how you got, it'd be like being involved in the boys club or going to school and doing sports. That's essentially what this meant. And while you could see, especially looking back on it, you can see the pieces of propaganda already working its way into it. It's very understanding at a certain point to see where people didn't see this as a warning because we didn't know the history of what would end up happening. It follows some of these people, and they talk about someone growing up and becoming guards places and elsewhere. And there's this one guy, he's like talking about when people would hide on his property, his family would turn him in, because if they didn't turn him in, they would be shot. And you see where a lot of these people are in precarious situations. And what's real interesting is when the rubber starts really hitting the road in this movie is when people are confronted with the, why didn't you do anything? Why did you do this knowing that this was bad? Or did you know it was bad? And of course you get the standard, well, nobody knew exactly what was going on. And then there's this one guy who's like, that's BS, because you could smell the smoke from the ovens and you would see the trains bringing people in and never bringing people out. And, you know, if you worked as a guard, you'd saw the killings and you saw the abuse. But more realistically, as you heard people talk about, well, you know, if you were a dissenter, you would be put in the camps as well. And then that starts to make it understandable why people kept their heads down and didn't speak out against this. But the real interesting ones is especially talking to these older people, who some of them are in their 90s, and them coming to terms with what they were involved in, for example. And there are some people who are like, still don't believe it, because they were indoctrinated so well back then that they found it impossible to believe that their beloved fatherland would do this. And I think it's a great lesson that you can be patriotic and you can love your country, but you can also acknowledge if your country committed atrocities. Put it in perspective of America. You can be a patriot and love America, but you can also recognize that the treatment of the American Indians was horrible. And some of the things that were done to the American Indians were wrong. A lot of things were wrong. You know, stuff like the Trail of Tears was wrong. And you can acknowledge that. And in fact, you have to acknowledge that, because just loving your country doesn't mean your country can do nothing wrong, or you can be ashamed of behavior of yourself. And if there's anything that we can take from this documentary, it is that it is okay to recognize the problems that your government and country has and the atrocities it has committed in the past. Blind patriotism is a dangerous thing, and we need to understand that. It's either that or face the consequences in history. And it's okay to speak out against things. And thank God we live in a country where you're allowed to speak out against things that you think are wrong. So I'm going to have to say, Final Account, it's a tough movie to watch and it's challenging, but it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Solos. Amazon Prime debuts this limited series featuring 7 episodes of single actors examining their lives and fears.
Hello? A memory isn't simply a thing you have. It's a promise.
A story, Mommy. A happy one.
Oh, we had this secret handshake.
They'll never forget you.
How do you know?
They'll remember.
The catch of this, it was actually, I believe, filmed during the pandemic, and that makes sense because most of them involve one or two actors in a very limited location. Like, for example, the very first episode is Anne Hathaway working in her basement trying to get a time travel communication device working. So it's sort of like Black Mirror in the sense that it falls in the realm of science fiction and it uses some of the Black Mirror tropes, like the ability to access memories and record them. It's a little more optimistic than Black Mirror. It doesn't go as dark as Black Mirror does, but it does have a dark side to it. And each episode's about half hour long, and there are 7 different actors spotlighted. And some of the episodes are really interesting, particularly the one with Anne Hathaway, because she's talking to different versions of herself throughout time. But then there's also Anthony Mackie playing a guy who's dying, who basically buys a robot to replace him, and he has to talk to himself to teach him how to be himself. And that's really interesting because it looks at the human factor of it. And this is the thing with Amazon. They're throwing down behind some really interesting speculative fiction pieces, like something like Tales from the Loop, which I wasn't a huge fan of, but I like the fact that it examined things through a speculative fiction lens. So there are some really neat episodes. The one with Helen Mirren is less plot driven and more character driven. And the finale with Morgan Freeman and Dan Stevens kind of wraps some of this together. I think it's a neat series, especially how they managed to film it during a pandemic and make it make sense. I mean, they're essentially bottle episodes of 7 different TV shows featuring one actor giving a real spotlight. And some are better than others. Well, Constance, well, she's not great. And I mean, it's clearly a part where she's really trying to act her guts out. But I got to say, this was an interesting series. It's worth checking out. So I'm going to say that Solos rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Army of the Dead and MODOK. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about, I guess this would be the big film of the weekend. It's on Netflix, and it actually had a release in theaters last weekend, in limited release. Now, they didn't release the box office numbers. I couldn't find any box office numbers on how well this did over last weekend, but it was in, you know, several hundred theaters, and it's still playing throughout this week, but if you have Netflix, you can watch it now. And that is Army of the Dead. Zack Snyder directs this action flick about a mercenary who brings his team into the walled-off city of Las Vegas, which has been overrun by zombies, in order to steal $200 million from a casino vault.
There's $200 million in the vault beneath the strip, with a 32-hour window to get it out. Find the safe. This should be a simple in-and-out.
It's not too late to go back.
They're not what you think they are. They're smarter. They're faster. They're organized.
I'll admit that over the last couple of years, I've been somewhat critical of Zack Snyder. I have enjoyed his earlier stuff. Like, speaking of zombies, I go back to Dawn of the Dead. I thought his was a great version of Dawn of the Dead. I thought he brought zombies into the 21st century just as well and effectively as Danny Boyle did with 28 Days Later. Now, Army of the Dead, it's not a horror movie. It's not a horror movie. I mean, it has blood and guts in it and has zombies and there's brains splattered all over the place. And it is a bona fide R-rated violent movie, but it's not a horror. It's not scary. And it's not only is meant to be. And they don't even have the scenes of, I mean, there's some creepy scenes where they're trapped in certain locations, but it's essentially an action movie. And it has a decent cast. It has a big cast. It's weirdly large in terms of the cast. Dave Bautista sort of leads the gang, and he's a mercenary who's... Because what had happened was there was a zombie outbreak outside of Las Vegas, and then the government walled off the city, and the zombies can't get out, and they're getting ready to nuke the city to get rid of all the zombies. And so this guy wants them to break into this casino and get the money out of the vault that's there. Which, fine, I mean, you watch the movie and you're like, well, that's a lot of money to carry. I mean, $200 million, that would be a lot, you know? And you watch this thing and you're like, you know, it's a suicide mission for a lot of these people. And they just don't seem to care. But that's your typical, you know, bloody action movie. It's sort of like in Wrath of Man. If you remember the bad guys who were running the ops that took out Jason Statham's kid that put him on the rampage, they were like, yeah, let's do this. It's okay. Well, you know, we may all die, but that's okay. I don't understand that mentality, but it's one of those. There's so many points in this movie where they say, oh, just go with it. And so they sneak into there and they get it. Now you've got Dave Bautista. His daughter is in an internment camp for people who had escaped Las Vegas, but they didn't know if they were infected yet. But he's trying to do it to help her out, but she ends up going in with him. So everybody's going into this zombie fortress, and it's typical Zack Snyder, lots of slow motion, lots of milked scenes, lots of plain music, where it feels very music video-ish. But I mean, it's not as much, I mean, it doesn't milk it the way like Justice League did, although this movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes. I don't think there's any reason for it to be that long, aside from the fact that Zack Snyder insists that his movies need to be that long. What's weird about it is this weird mix of dumb, rock stupid, Luddite action. It looks like, in some ways, that Zack Snyder's trying to be Michael Bay. And that's where it gets a little dull, but I realize that that's the kind of thing that people who like run-and-gun zombie movies, that's what they're going to be drawn to. But then there's elements to it that actually are kind of clever. And you hear it in the trailer, but the whole point is that it's not just mindless zombies in here. There are zombies and they have sort of a structure, and there are alpha zombies and just sort of the, I forget what they call them, like the scramblers, whatever, the other zombies that just kind of stumble around. And there's some sort of directive behind it in a society. And I've always found that interesting. I've always found that much more interesting than just, oh, everybody just wants to eat flesh or brains and that's it. So they don't fully explore that, which is a shame because there's some great ideas buried in this movie that aren't kind of brought out completely to fruition. But then again, it's a movie about a bunch of people saying, yeah, let's go into Las Vegas and you know, with a couple guns, and we should be able to survive the zombies. So it's a zombie movie, lots of running, gunning, lots of shooting, lots of blood splattering, has some neat ideas, but ultimately it does settle out to just be a zombie movie with not a whole lot of surprises. But then again, if you like that sort of thing, if you want to see a running gun zombie movie, this is your bag, man. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about MODOK. This is a series on Hulu. based on the supervillain from Marvel Comics, this stop-motion animated series tells the story of a megalomaniacal genius who must put his world domination on hold to deal with a corporate takeover and a divorce.
They called me Big Head.
One day, that big head of yours is going to change the world.
Time to change the world by bringing it to its knees! Attack!
Where does he go at night?
Nobody knows.
We have to tell the kids about us.
Kids, she's lost her mind. You have to stop her.
Moda, what are you telling the kids?
I'm comforting them. And if you tell her I said any of this, this will be one of the many divorces where it is the kid's fault.
You can hear that is clearly Patton Oswalt doing the voice of MODOK. He helped create this show. Now, look, I have not read the Marvel comics religiously at all. I've maybe read, you know, a dozen comics over the years. So I really don't have any sort of history, and I'm not familiar with the history of MODOK as a villain. As I understand, he started out as a real supervillain, kind of a Brainiac type. So this has taken a much more silly turn. It's made to be a comedy, and it's been developed fully with Marvel Entertainment, but they're sort of splitting it off into their TV group. And I actually give them credit for this, because I like the fact that Marvel is allowing more things to be done outside of just their Marvel Cinematic Universe. And that's good, because not everything has to be that, and you should diversify the product and diversify the shows. It's sort of like how they would still do animated versions of these movies. You get a Spider-Man movie, but you get a bunch of Spider-Man TV shows. Same thing with Fantastic Four. In fact, the animated Fantastic Four stuff is way better than any of the series that they've made. So if you've got Disney Plus, go watch that stuff. But MODOK is meant to be a comedic show. It's done by the people who did Robot Chicken. So it's got the stop-motion animation. It's got the irreverent humor. It's adult-oriented. So there's swearing and dirty jokes and that sort of thing. But the whole point is that MODOK has this evil organization that's been taken over in a corporate takeover, and he's dealing with the fact that his wife wants to leave him and get a divorce, and he's got two kids that he's still dealing with. So it's him trying to be a supervillain, but dealing with all the other crap that you got to deal with as a human. And that's where the comedy comes in. And if they have different cameos by different characters, like Iron Man shows up every now and then. And, you know, I mean, it's not Robert Downey Jr. doing the voice, because it exists outside of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's its own thing. So it's not made necessarily for Marvel fans, but it's more made for fans of adult animation, you know, stuff like Rick and Morty, where it delves into a lot of stuff that Rick and Morty have, because he's this super genius who creates all this technology that allows him to travel through time and take over the world or whatever. So it does have that Rick and Morty flair to it, but it also has the Robot Chicken flair, and it's got the look of a stop motion animation rather than a CGI thing, which is, that's kind of neat to see. You know, we don't get a lot of that anymore. So almost everything's CGI. But it's not to be taken seriously. It's silly and it's stupid, but it's also very funny at times. And I gotta say, if you want to just watch something that you don't have to pay attention to, and it can be a real lark and just an escape, if you need that half hour to get away, check out MODOK. It's pretty funny. It's on Hulu right now, and I'm going to say it totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dream Horse and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring The Vigil. Two Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews with Dream Horse. Based on a true story, this film follows a group of everyday people in a small village in Wales who breed their own championship racehorse.
I need something to look forward to when I get up in the morning. I'm going to breed a racehorse.
He's normally wealthy professional. He's not going for this kind of thing.
There's ways of doing these things, isn't there? 20 people in the village put in a tenner a week for 2 years.
When the horse is born, everyone will be owners.
We'll all have an equal share.
We need a name.
What about Dream Alliance? Is our dream, and we're all in it together, so Dream Alliance.
Dream Alliance!
Dream Alliance!
I actually saw the documentary that this is based on. about 5-6 years ago, and I believe I covered it on the show. And I believe I said back at that time, I haven't gone back to the archive and checked, but I'm pretty sure I said this would make a great narrative feature. Well, they've made a narrative feature out of it. And the whole story is about this little alliance of people who were in this little village, and they're in Wales, and they like each get together and they put 10 quid in a week, and they then have enough money for the stud fees for a stallion to, they go get this mare who's a championship mare, but she's older. You know, she's no longer racing, and they get this stallion and they get a breeding thing. And the woman who's in charge of it, and the woman who kind of spearheads the whole thing, played by Toni Collette, she does all of her research because she has bred other things like pigeons and other animals over the years. It's kind of a little bit of a farming type community. And they get this horse and they breed this colt that grows up, and they, you know, it's about a town that is suffering. That's really what it's about. It's not about a horse. I mean, it is, but it's not about a horse. The story is about a horse, but the movie is about human interactions and the ups and downs of life. And so, I mean, everybody's suffering in this town. They're dealing with economic issues and that sort of thing. And I believe the actual story takes place in like the 80s or 90s. I don't think it's too recent. I don't know. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've seen the documentary. But this one takes place in the not too distant past. They don't nail down the year. But people are suffering, and they're having their own hardships and their own issues. And this really pulls them all together as a community, as a group of people. And they learn to come together, and there's, you know, just some magic that happens with this horse, and they're able to get it trained properly and entered into races, and they start seeing some really great results. And it's about, you know, I mean, as corny as it is to say Dream Horse, because that's the horse's name is Dream Alliance. And you can go back and look it up. Dream Alliance actually had this well-known record, if you follow Welsh horse racing, but it was a big deal. And I mean, as corny as it is to say it's about making your dreams come true, that's really what it is. And it's about being part of something bigger than yourself at the time. And it's about working together as a community and coming together as a community. And sure, there's ups and downs in it and everything, and they run into some pretty horrible things that happen. And I remember some of this, of course, from the documentary. But you know, they stick together, and it's very inspiring. And like I said, you don't have to understand horse racing. You don't have to follow horse racing. You don't have to be a big fan of the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness and all that kind of stuff. I can't even name. I know that we just had that stuff. I don't know what the horse's name that won those things. So I don't follow that, but I still really appreciated this movie. And, you know, every couple of years we get a good horse movie. You know, we had Seabiscuit, what, about 20 years ago? And then you had Secretariat about 10 years ago. Well, now we got Dream Horse. And it's a sweet story. It got some great acting in it. Toni Collette holds it together really, really well, giving an authentic performance. Damian Lewis plays he's a former racehorse owner who helps show them the ropes on how it works once you actually have a horse to race. It's a great little movie, and it's uplifting. And right now, you know, over the last year, and even over the last 4 or 5 years, things have been so downtrodden in people's lives and attitudes, and social media and just interaction with people has become so contentious. And there's so much doom and gloom out there that it's nice to see something uplifting. And that's what this offers. And I think that's great. So I'm going to have to say that Dream Horse rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today in home cinema, I want to spotlight a movie that's come to Hulu. It came out earlier this year, and it just blipped on the radar because nobody saw it. And I think nobody saw it because it was a smaller release from IFC. But I want to give it a little bit of a shout out here. It's called The Vigil. A man who has recently left Orthodox Judaism agrees to, in accordance with Jewish tradition, keep a vigil over the body of a dead man only to face a malevolent spirit.
This is Lidvark. There is something very, very wrong here.
We have to go now.
It won't let you live.
Mrs. Litvak, what won't let me leave?
The magic. It will make you see terrible things.
This is one of those movies that draws from Jewish tradition to make a horror movie. And we've seen this before. There was that movie, The Possession, several years ago, starred Jeffrey Dean Morgan. And it was about a Dybbuk box, or the Dybbuk box. I guess there is one Dybbuk box where a guy had claimed to have caught a Dybbuk and contained it in this wine box, and they made a movie out of it. Now, usually when you have a horror movie, they usually slide right into the Catholic Church. You know, there's always exorcisms, and I even joked about it when they had that movie, The Unholy, earlier this year, which I didn't think was terrible. But I remember joking about that, saying, you know, Hollywood is relatively secular, and, you know, every time they do a horror movie, suddenly everybody finds Jesus. And they do, but sometimes you have other movies that are told from a different religious perspective. There was a movie, and it must have been 6-7 years ago, and I don't even remember the name of it, but it was an Iranian movie, and it was about a haunting there. So it came from a very Islamic point of view, because it was made by and for Muslims in Iran. And this one is, it's not made in Israel, but it's steeped in Jewish traditions. Which, of course, if anybody has ever interacted, and you see this actually in movies showing up, they talk about sitting with the body. There was that movie with Jason Bateman, and Adam Driver was in it, where they had to sit with his father. You know, you have that sitting Shiva. But when there's no family there, they actually have hired people who come in and will sit, and they'll read the scripture, and they'll read the Talmud, and, you know, and overnight. Because in Jewish tradition, you're supposed to have somebody there watch over the body. Well, you have in this movie, you have this spirit called a mazik. And it's a real thing in Jewish tradition. But what's interesting about these spirits in the Jewish tradition is generally in Judaism, you don't have a devil, you don't have hell, you don't have demons. There's stuff that is sent, or is part of the world that maybe gets sent by God to either have you confront something you've done, some grief or guilt you have, or it's a punishment for something. And that's what this is about. It's not necessarily just about some evil, malevolent spirit that wants to eat your soul. That's a very Christian-based type of a horror story. This is much more Jewish-based. This guy's carrying some horrible stuff in his heart, and even stuff that has made him leave Orthodox Judaism. And so it's making him confront that. And it's an effectively done movie. It's very creepy. It's very limited space, because it's him taking care of this body and reading over this body. But then he's having images, and the wife of the dead man, who she's upstairs because she's, you know, he's not quite with it. And so the rabbi didn't want to leave her doing it, and they needed somebody else to do it so she could sleep. And so it sets itself up really well. And immediately you see it, you're like, well, this is going to be creepy as all get out. And it uses light and shadow, and it does it in such a way too. I've always been critical of movies that do too much darkness, because it then becomes impossible to see anything. They do a really good job balancing the light and the darkness, and to add this creepy torment that this guy's going through. So it's an effective movie. It's worth checking out. If you have Hulu, it's on there right now. You can see it with the service. It debuted this week. And I'm going to have to say that The Vigil kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other movies that are newly available on DVD and Blu-ray include Minari, Tom and Jerry the Movie, Star Trek Lower Decks Season 1, The Father, Hunted, Supernova, and a couple 4K releases. You've got Animal House and The Sting. And that's it. I've got to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Cruella and A Quiet Place Part 2. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.